Welcome to Found at TU, a monthly podcast where we talk with University of Tulsa faculty about their research, how they do it, why they love it, and what they are finding out. I'm Jolie Jensen, Hazel Rogers Professor of Media Studies at the University of Tulsa, and today we're here with Professor Akhilesh Bajaj, the Chapman Professor of Computer Information Systems. Welcome to Found at TU, Akhilesh.
Thanks, Jolie.
I always begin the same way, so we'd like you to tell us in one simple sentence what you study.
So essentially, my research looks at how we can use information systems to help organizations work better, and also personally to how people can work better with them.
And so tell me what an information system is.
So an information system, I guess our major is called computer information systems, but it's not just a computer. It could be information that's somehow consolidated and then used to make better decisions in some cases, to, that's a big portion of it. And then also to increase the productivity, that could be one aspect, to just basically do things better.
So any system, really, that an organization uses to try to coordinate its activities, what measure its productivity?
A system that has information as its foundation. So computers are a great way to do that. But, you know, before that, you can use paper, you can use tablets, you can use the World Wide Web. So there's lots of...
A variety of modes. So was there such a thing as information systems as a academic area before computers, or did it grow up at the same time?
No, it kind of grew with computers, actually. So once computers came out in the 60s is when businesses really started adopting them, the big businesses, and then the 70s. So the information systems disciplines really started coming out in the 80s. Academically,
so it's
in business
relatively
schools.
A relatively new
it
field.
It is a new discipline. The one at TU has been here since the 80s. It's one of the older.
Oh, really?
One of the older academic programs in the country, actually.
Well, that's good to know. Yeah. So how did you get interested in this area?
So I got my MBA. So I first came to the U.S. to do my MBA and did that.
So to study business and business administration.
Right. Yeah, I'm undergraduate with engineering, but then I decided to do an MBA. Mm-hmm. So came here and did my MBA at Cornell. Then I was working with Citibank in New York, and this was in the early 90s. Huh. And so my first job out of MBA was to run a funds transfer unit where we were moving money from the U.S. to other countries.
Okay.
That lasted 6 months, and then my next job was to actually manage a team to build an information system for this other unit that I was supervising earlier. So that really got me into the power of information systems. And so... this project was built in 1991, mm-hmm. and it was written by programmers in India, and we were based in New York. So there was a lot of coordination issues, and you know, this was before the web, so...
Oh.
Yeah, 1991. So,
you were building your own system, which wasn't all that common at that time for the
unit. Yeah,
it
was a custom-built system for the unit, and it was being built in India, so there was a lot of remote management going on. So there were a lot of issues that I learned, and I saw the power of, you know, information systems, and kind of really got me interested in that, so... I decided to do a PhD a couple of years after that, and I was thinking, what academic discipline should I do? Mm-hmm. I was debating between marketing and MIS, and I was like, okay, I think I'm going to do MIS just because it's...
MIS is Management and Information Systems.
And it's called by different names, Computer Information Systems or just Information Systems. So I decided I would do that, and that's how I got started.
So you understood from that experience when you were simply an MBA working that things can go right and things can go wrong, obviously. So what, when you were studying it, were you trying to understand how to do it well then, to best practices? Or what would you say characterizes as the main goal of any information systems researcher is to figure out how to make things...
Yeah, so there's two sides to information systems research within the area itself. Mm-hmm. There's what you would call the more traditional side, which is... more social science driven, where we try to look at motivations for using information systems and how they cause social change within an organization.
Okay.
And so on. So there's a lot of theories that are borrowed from organizational theories, you know, mm-hmm. And that are used to apply to the information system, you know, as a symbol or as an artifact and so on. So that's one part. And that's what I would call the more traditional information systems. And that's where a lot of the foundational research is. Mm-hmm. And then there's another subsection, which is, I think the outside public would probably consider that more mainstream, but it's not really, which mm-hmm. is what I would call the design science aspect, where we talk about how can we build better information systems? How can we design them to make the organizations work better? So how do we get requirements, for example, from people and then build a better information system? So since I'm an engineer and I worked in industry, and that's been my sort of areas to really work more on the how do we build better information systems.
So it's the design
science. The design science aspect, yeah.
And that would mean, can you give us a sense of how you would do your research or an example of a research project that would help us understand?
Yeah, so now when I said I do design science, that's my main area, but I also do some of the theory building type science.
The more social science.
Social science, yeah, where we use existing theory. So, but if you look at a typical design science project, that would be, we look at an existing method, let's say for some aspect of information systems building. So let's say requirement solicitation. So how do I get requirements from people, right?
People who work in an organization, what they might need from
right,
the information
what we call
system.
The end users. How do we get the end users to, for example, specify the data needs? So it's hard to get people to specify the data needs, right? I mean, if I ask you what you do, you would tell me what you do. But if I ask you what the data needs are, you would kind of...
It's hard to... Yeah, we don't think in those
terms
usually.
Yeah, you don't think
usually.
In those terms. Yeah. So what's a good way for me to capture that? So there's existing methods to do that. I could just observe what you do, for example, or I could look at the reports you process. Mm-hmm. But there may be other things. So... And not only what you use, but what would you actually like, you know, what would actually make your job better. So So I could talk to you, I could do interviews, and all of those are obviously established. But then how do I document that? How do I use that to design a better system?
Mm-hmm.
So there's methods out there. And then what I would probably do in this kind of a project would be to try and improve on the existing state-of-the-art method and propose a new method and then test it out in a like a real-world scenario or an experimental scenario. So that would be a, like a complete design science project where you come up with a way to do something a little bit better, and then you test it out.
Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about improving things that are already existing now, since almost all
right.
organizations have an information system in place.
Right.
Are there kind of one-size-fits-all models, or do each of them individually designed, or how does it work?
Yeah, are you talking about information systems?
Yeah, information systems in general, and then how your research would affect it.
So up to the 1980s, all information systems were pretty much custom built for the organization. So people were building their own. They had teams of, you know, programmers, and hardware was very expensive, and, you know, it was kept in like very carefully controlled rooms, and, you know, the IS team would wear white coats and walk around, and they would get requirements from people and they would document them. And a lot of these requirement solicitation methods came out in the 70s, actually, because the goal then was to get these requirements and then build a custom system.
Right.
What happened in the 80s was, of course, the PC came out and became adopted by the personal computer, was adopted by businesses, it became a desktop. And then there was a big upsurge of companies that were offering solutions that users could use. So so we call these off-the-shelf solutions.
Mm-hmm.
So companies like Oracle and all came up. And then there were a bunch of companies that started offering these ERP systems, enterprise resource planning systems, which basically support business functions. So these are like off-the-shelf solutions. So they would provide you a working system where you would take your company's data and migrate it to the system and then start using the screens that were provided.
Mm-hmm.
So these were small players until about the mid-1990s. Mid-1990s, what happened is that there was a big Y2K crisis that started.
Oh, right.
And so people were... So there was this big fear created that company software would crash, you know, in the
right,
year 2000.
And
the big thing was the date bug, you know, the date fields, and also they had to go through all the code that they had, some of which was written like 20, 30 years ago, and then try and figure out what was wrong. So at that point, there were two choices for companies. One was to pay a lot of expensive labor to scan through the code, or the other was to simply replace the code with an off-the-shelf system. And so a lot of the off-the-shelf systems were adopted in the 1990s. And companies paid quite a lot of money for that.
Yeah.
Another thing that companies were doing in the 1990s was they were trying to move towards becoming a more process-oriented organization. So that was a big buzzword in the 90s. And to do that, again, they would use the information system as a way to sort of bridge the gap between silos, the information gap, so that people could share information. So that you weren't judged just on your performance as a salesperson, but you were judged on the process that you supported.
Ability to connect with others.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so... You needed a system that could actually span all the functions.
Mm-hmm.
So again, these off-the-shelf systems became a better way to do that, at least a quicker way, rather than building one from scratch that sort of spanned everybody's information. Because then you had to get people together and work through the politics. And it just became a hard thing to do.
Yeah.
So at the moment, most of the big systems out there are off-the-shelf. They're bought off-the-shelf. But they are not without their problems. So in fact, they have quite a few problems. And one of the things I found is that companies that actually invest the time to build their own systems tend to be much happier with them in the long run.
Ah, okay. So your research, one of your major research findings is that companies that take the time and effort to build their own systems succeed more in the long run because they're more...
So some of the drawbacks of these off-the-shelf systems, right? If you buy an off-the-shelf system, your competitors can buy it too. So you're not getting any competitive advantage from the mm-hmm. system itself. Mm-hmm. So you're losing out on that. Now, the second thing is when you buy a system, it comes configured already with the back-end database and the front-end screens. So all you do is when you try to adapt it to your organization, it becomes a much harder fit because your data has to fit this.
The preset.
These preset limits, tables.
Yeah.
Now, what you can do is you can try to customize the tables and the screens, but then the problem is the vendors will update the system every 2 or 3 years, and then you've got to go and redo it all.
Every time,
so
yes.
It becomes kind of an expensive exercise. So a lot of companies try it once, and then they sort of go back to the stock system. The advantage of these off-the-shelf systems is that they have all the rules and regulations you need to abide by sort of hardwired in. Mm-hmm. And if you're building a custom system, you would need to put in all those rules. So that's the advantage. Now, the other problem with these off-the-shelf systems is that they're not very flexible. So once your employees are trained on this new system, if they maybe come up with a better way to do something, they're still tied to that system. They can't really go away from that system. They have to feed the system. So essentially what ends up happening is that people end up sort of building their own little mini systems on the side to optimize their work. Yeah, to optimize the work, and then they feed the big system as sort of a system of record.
Ah.
So that's another disadvantage. So in a sense, you kind of lose your competitive advantage. Uh-huh. And if you think about all the companies that have really used the systems to make money, like let's say Walmart is a classic example, you know, sort of beating all the other retailers in the 1990s and the 2000s.
And so Walmart built their own system?
Yeah, they absolutely built their own system that mm-hmm. tracked everything, and then they used that information. So you need a system that gives you that competitive advantage that your competitors cannot easily.
So it's unique
build.
To your own organization, and it responds more to the actual needs of the users as well as the various components of the organization.
Yeah, and it also adapts.
It's more flexible and adaptive.
Yes. Yeah, and you own the code, so you can update it as you like. You don't have to wait for the vendor to update it.
Or have to scramble to adjust when they do update
right.
it.
Now, yes. The downside to building your own is that there's greater risk. You need someone who can manage the process. You need support from top-down management. It's much easier to be a customer to a vendor than to actually drive a project that is risky.
Mm-hmm.
So you need that support. But on the plus side, the technology needed to build a system is actually pretty well understood now. So you can quite easily deploy a web-based system that's custom. It's much easier to do that now than it was, let's say, 15, 20 years ago.
And I presume that it's easier to find information technology support staff, too, because they know the basics, and you're just customizing off of a fairly well-understood basis.
Yeah, I'll give you a real story if you want.
Oh, great. Yes, real stories are wonderful.
So I won't name the company involved, but when I was in Pittsburgh, there was a company that I was consulting with, which was a big nonprofit in D.C. So the CIO took an executive class with me,
mm-hmm.
and then I was called in to help them with the system. So they had bought an off-the-shelf system to support, let's say, probably 15 to 20 employees in the organization. They had spent $150,000, this is around the year 2001, on the system, and it was just lying unused on the shelf.
Huh.
So they called me in and said, okay, can you build us a custom system? So went in, took one other person with me to help, got all the requirements from these 20 people using my own method, built them a system from scratch, a web-based system in 2001, which is good. Their old system was actually like on an old IBM PC, and they had these, you know, these control F12 and F11
yes,
type keys, monochrome.
Yes.
This was on the web. It was light years ahead of what they had. And I think the total cost, if I remember, was about $80,000.
Hmm.
And this was customized to everybody. Everybody had access to the screens that they wanted and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the power of a customized system. And they owned the source code. It was their system.
Mm-hmm.
And it was fairly easy to maintain. You know, but you need people on board who can maintain it.
Right, and that will stay around, right?
Right,
and
right.
So, you've got to
keep so you need a way to preserve that knowledge even as employees leave.
Mm-hmm.
So you need
mm-hmm.
a way to document your system. And so you need to have practices in place if you build your own system. But once you do it, then it's you have that advantage, you know. So
you mentioned as you're telling that story, using your own methods too. So I want to go back to that because it interests me. You said it's hard sometimes for people to know what their needs are. So how is it that you get the information that you need to design a good custom system?
I like to start with the data. So mm-hmm. I'm basically a database person. So there's two ways to do it, right? One is to come up with the processes and then sort of create the data. But what I like to do is to, and this is a skill process, is to ask people what they do, but as they're doing it, draw a data model. And so essentially a data model would be all the data fields that they're using.
Mm-hmm.
So as they talk, sort of involve them in the process and then have them. So the most popular data model right now is something called the entity relationship model, which is a graphical model that allows you to capture data fields. I use a variant of that, and then I've come up with my own model, which actually uses markup tables instead of, basically it asks the users to build their own screens.
Okay.
But it's kind of works the same way. But I like to start with the data and then come up with a list of all the data fields they need.
Mm-hmm.
And then the processes sort of just fall out. So, you know, when you're talking about your data, you are automatically thinking of your processes. So I start with that.
And it sounds like you work with individuals then to kind of help them articulate what they may not automatically say. But once you talk in that language, they can start thinking about what would work for them.
Yeah. So essentially, like for this project, for example, I had all the 15 people sit in a room
mm-hmm.
and we spent 2 days in that room. And at the end of it, we had a data model down.
And one that they were invested in, too, right?
Yeah, because they had built it. Yeah, absolutely, yeah. They had built it. So as opposed to talking to each one individually, you sit in a place and you work out all your differences and you come up with a common model that everyone agrees on, and that's the foundation. And after that, it becomes fairly easy to build a system.
Wow. I would think that a lot of people, maybe not so much anymore, but there's a hesitancy, a feeling that there's this impersonal, imposed from above system. And what you're describing is a way that people feel much more comfortable, right? Have they looked at it as a way of building, as team building? Or
yes, absolutely. So that's another aspect where people have looked at these group sessions as a way to team build. Now, what happened in this system, for example, is that everybody loved it except for two people who lost their power, who were controlling the old system. So they were opposed to it. So there's these power shifts that happen with every system, and that's another area of research. So again, this group process is really good for bringing these things out and finally coming with a model that, you know, everyone can agree on, as opposed to these. So these top-down systems that come in, these off-the-shelf systems, they're really hard to implement in an organization because people fight over who gets what screens, the power, you know, of the controlling the information. So it actually becomes harder sometimes to implement these off-the-shelf systems.
That's another disadvantage then, is that people feel disempowered and shoved into categories and no one wants to have to learn a new system anyway, right?
Yes.
So tell me what you enjoy most about your research. What is the pleasure and reward of doing it?
Just the domain itself of helping organizations and people and just coming up with new methods is kind of exciting for me. I've also done some work in the computer science domain, which is different from computer information mm-hmm. systems, which is more technical. And then I also do some of the social sciences, psychometric construct type research. So the fact that I can switch between these areas is kind of fun.
Yeah.
So I'm not constrained with just one particular sort of domain or one particular methodology, rather.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of makes it fun for me. So you can have different projects that you're working on.
And can follow your interests. And
yeah.
So do you go back to places that you've researched and see how things are 5 years down the road, or do longitudinal, or how do you?
Yeah, so I haven't done, I did one longitudinal study, but that was only like 6 weeks. So in general, longitudinal studies are not done in IS simply because, one, the systems don't last too long, and two, the resources that are needed, right? I mean, that's something that one could do. The other thing that I like about the domain is that it's changing all the time. So what I was researching in 1995 is obviously out of date. And with all the stuff that's coming around the horizon, the fact that the pace of change is actually accelerating. I mean, it's
really still?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, so what kinds of changes are happening in the field right now?
Just to go over, let's say, from the 1990s. So in the 1990s, we had the PC sort of revolution, which became really adopted mainstream. And you had this architecture called the client-server architecture, where they had servers.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of contained all your information, and then people had the PC clients and you could log in. And so that was the dominant sort of architecture in the 1990s. In the 2000s, the dominant architecture became the web. And everybody was using these thin clients, which are basically web browsers.
Uh-huh.
And again, you had these centralized servers, but then you didn't have stuff on your desktop. You just had the web browser and you had access to information anywhere. Mm-hmm. You could telecommute and so on. So all of that was in the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm.
From 2010 onwards, and I'm being very approximate here, but from 2010 onwards, it's been Web 2.0, where systems are talking to each other a lot more, and a lot of stuff has become automated. They're sharing data automatically.
Oh.
So, for example, you don't have to call up your vendors anymore to ship stuff to you. I mean, your suppliers to ship stuff to you.
It's
all automatic. It's, you know, RFID, for example. Like, you can just drive through your toll pass. You don't have to stop. Similarly, when pallets of inventory come in, they're automatically clocked in. You don't have to physically clock anything.
Yes.
So all of that, systems sort of talking to each other. We've seen that in our personal life, too, where your phone can do things for you in a much more smart way.
So that's happening in organizations, too.
Yeah, absolutely. And it actually started in organizations.
They usually take the lead, I presume.
Yeah,
and
yeah,
then it becomes
the cost savings.
Home.
Right. So that's been up to now. Now, what's coming down the pike is basically fundamental changes in how we actually make decisions. So, for example, a lot of businesses right now are up to now, maybe for the last 300-400 years, have been what I would call middlemen. So every business is a middleman in something. So just examples, like the obvious is financial institutions that are middlemen in transactions. You know, if I want to buy something, then the bank is a middleman.
The bank is the middleman.
If I want to drive my car, then the traffic, the DMV is a middleman that sort of monitors what I do. If I want to get an education, then the university is a middleman. A lot of business models are founded on this middleman gatekeeping type role. And there's this thing called blockchains that have come out over the last 10 years.
Are you going to explain blockchains for us?
Sure. Blockchains is just a way to store your information so that you don't need a middleman to verify the accuracy of the information. So they are stored for everyone to see, and they are hack-proof, supposed to be hack-proof. And everybody can verify what has happened, so you don't really need a middleman anymore. So now you can do peer-to-peer transactions without a middleman to verify them. That's basically what blockchain is. So Bitcoin is the classic example of a blockchain where you have a currency that doesn't require a middleman. So a currency is a classic example of a middleman needing to manage it.
Yes.
Not with blockchains. So you can have, in fact, there's a ton of blockchain-based currencies now that which are called cryptocurrencies that you can trade on, and there's no middle person managing them. So
what?
And I hate saying middleman. I should say middle person.
Middle person.
You know what
we
I mean.
Understand.
Yeah, yeah.
So what are the expected changes from your point of view then?
So a lot of the
systems point of view?
So a lot of just the way organizations do business, they don't need middlemen anymore.
Being transformed.
And they themselves will get transformed, right? So, like, what is the role of the university, for example, as blockchains come out? I mean, right now, a big role of universities is verifying that a student is qualified to do something.
Certification.
Process, yes. And if you have blockchain-based certification, then what's the role of the university? Because you could have independent certifiers that certify you, and that's all they do. And then everyone knows you're certified.
Get knowledge
you don't
way
need that
you
degree.
Want it.
Yeah, you don't need that signaling of the degree, right? So that's one thing.
Or the process leading up to it. So banks and Walmart and everything.
Yeah, loans, there's a whole process. Loans, for example, real estate transactions, buying a car, just anything that requires a middle person or a middleman is going to change.
Well,
the
middle
next
organization. So it's really a, so the employment shifts dramatically because
so that's a huge thing.
A lot of people to serve that middleman role.
Exactly. So that's going to stop, I guess, over time. The other thing, of course, is AI and, you know, how it's taking over everything that we're doing, artificial intelligence. The conventional wisdom has been that jobs that are more structured and more deterministic can be easily automated, but jobs that require quote-unquote higher cognitive skills or, you know, that are unstructured, that are flexible, not so easy to automate. But if you look at AI, it is simulating being intelligent quite well now. So it's composing symphonies, it's writing books, it's
doing psychotherapy.
So if you look at Bloom's taxonomy, the higher level skills like analysis and synthesis, AI is doing that quite well. Of course, it's doing the analysis that doctors and all do too. And so if you couple that with the sort of information being available, for example, for diagnosis, if I have all the information I need to make the diagnosis on the web, and then I have an AI that does it for me, the AI is going to be much better informed than a doctor, than a human, because the human cannot retain all that information in the head that's on the web. So the AI can use that and come up with ways to, you know, using neural nets and so on, ways to do a diagnosis that's much more accurate than a human. Look at teaching, for example. I mean, I could teach on my best day, I could maybe reach like, you know, 60% of my class, connect with them if I'm in lecture mode. And if I'm a really good teacher, maybe I reach 70. If I'm a bad teacher, I reach 30%, right? And it's got to do with, you know, what I ate for lunch and what the students ate for lunch and what time of the day it is, sort of learning styles for that particular domain, my style of teaching, people's moods. Now, you compare that to an AI that is, let's say, teaching someone that is delivering content and testing the person as they do it. It's doing it in an infinitely patient way. It's watching the micro expressions of that person. It's changing the way it delivers content. I mean, I can't really compete with that as a human. So really, I mean, no human can. So there's all these things that AI is going to take over. Obviously, driving cars, you know, maybe flying planes. You'll still need a human in the loop, I guess. But at some point, the AI does it all. In many domains, AI is going to take over. So I think there's lots of studies that we are aware of that show that, you know, unemployment's going to. So it's all accelerating. It's becoming faster and faster. If you look at the Google Brain Project, they are basically, they're one of the directors of engineering, a guy called Ray Kurzweil, who's been around for a while. They're basically predicting that they will be able to build software that rivals the processing power of the human brain by 2029, I think. So, and after that, it's going to just grow. So by the year 2050, I think they're projecting a billion-fold increase. So it's all exponential, the rate of change. Yes. And we're just at the beginning.
Exciting times. Absolutely. So it's clear this is an exciting field that you're in.
Right.
And it's clear that you enjoy your work. If there are people listening who are interested in knowing more about information systems, what can you direct them to?
If you're looking at it from an academic point of view, I guess a good site is aisnet.org, which is the Association of Information Systems, is the academic society. Mm-hmm. If you want to look at the more business school aspects of it, if you want to look at the computer science aspects of it in a more approachable fashion than ACM,
what's ACM?
The Association of Computing Machinery. And I think it's acm.org. If you go online, you can see some of their articles, and they're more technical, but some of them are fairly approachable too. So they both have a magazine that they print called Communications. So Communications of the ACM and Communications of the AIS, which tend to write things in a more approachable fashion.
So people can learn about cutting-edge research,
absolutely,
what's going on.
Absolutely,
now.
Yeah. And so I would say those two. Now, of course, you can go on the web, and there's tons of articles that people write, you know, that you can find that talk about the social aspects of AIS and the impacts. You can go on The Atlantic, for example, and look at aspects of technology.
Well, I think right now, because of the exponential changes that you were describing, it's an area that we're both fascinated by and fearful of. And so we're trying to, and really your explanation of blockchain was one of the best I've heard.
Oh, thank you.
I've been struggling with that. So thank you so much.
Oh, I appreciate it. Thank you, Jolie.
I'm Jolie Jensen, and this has been Found It TU, a monthly podcast produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa on the TU campus. We've been talking with Dr. Akhilesh Bajaj about his research in information systems. Please join us next month for another chance to hear a University of Tulsa faculty member discuss in everyday language the nature and value of their research.